Welcome to the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. I'm your host, James Renford Powell, author of the Renford books, and specifically the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program that we have covered in 54 weeks on this show. We have had 54 emails with lessons go out to those who subscribed and 54 lessons covered on the show that go along with the book, the workbook, with five exercises per chapter and the four DVDs. Now, if you have a friend or anyone who would like to listen to the show and maybe on the road or not online and can't access the show from a computer, which you do by going to Blog Talk Radio, BLOGTALK, blogtalkradio.com/Renford, RENFORD. And this is one way of accessing the show. Or you can call in on 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. If you would like to ask a question, or yourself, or if any of those who call in on that number like to ask a question, just press the one button on your touchtone dial, and that'll flag me to bring you in for your question. And my guest is Pat Frescona. He's an attorney from Mississippi. I'll give you more rundown on him later. He was the attorney for John Burroughs, who was attempting to secure his disability income due to injuries resulting from exposure to an unidentified craft that had landed in Rendlesham Forest near the Bentwater Air Force Base in England. And we'll be talking about that. We may be joined also by Pat Bullock Williams and possibly by the client, Mr. Burroughs. As you can see, we're going far afield from personal development here, but these are very interesting situation. This one in particular, because it is a first-time situation, the government has done what it's done, and we're going to let Pat Frescona tell us all about that when we come back. Remember, if you want to ask a question or if you have anybody who wants to listen to the show that can't get online on the computer, just dial 347-838-9142 and press the one button in your touch-tone dial if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll talk a little bit more about this and other news tonight. But first, it's time for Renford Revelations, my blog. You can access these blogs by going to www.iamcor.org/blog. And these are generally a page and a half to two-page blogs, and you're welcome to respond positively or negatively. It makes no difference to me. I'd like to hear some responses whenever I can. This blog tonight is called Self-Transformation for Success. We can begin the process of breaking the bonds of mechanical thinking and transforming our lives into a labor of love. Along with being happier, we can be greatly rewarded once we recognize that there are certain universal principles which underwrite even the physical laws of nature. It is only meaningful to us if we can identify and verify these universal laws in our own life experiences. Only then are we in the position to say, I've been there and done that. Only then is the experience and the knowledge truly ours. It is important to move past blind faith in someone else's experience and make it real. Spinoza notes, there is no need that we should understand the series of individual mutable things, for their essence is only to be found in fixed and eternal things, and from the laws inscribed in those things as their true codes. according to which all individual things are made and arranged. Nay, these individual and mutable things depend so intimately and essentially on these fixed ones that without them they can neither exist nor be conceived. This is talking about invariant universal principle. Deepak Chopra, in his book Creating Affluence, describes the universal laws as a process. He wrote, "Law is the process by which the unmanifest becomes the manifest. It's the process by which the observer becomes the observed. It is the process by which the seer becomes the scenery. It's the process through which the dreamer manifests the dream. All of creation, everything that exists in the physical world, is the result of the unmanifest transforming itself into the manifest." He goes on to say, "The physical laws of the universe are actually this whole process of divinity in motion, or consciousness in motion. Is this not what we do when we conceive a business idea? At first, it is just an idea. We apply our thinking to this idea, and it becomes a concept. We develop the concept, and it becomes a plan of action. We develop a plan of action, and it is manifest in a business. In order to experience self-transformation, we must know ourselves. In order to break free of being mechanical, we must be free of the mechanical view. With this process of identifying and verifying the universal laws in our lives, we can clearly express ourselves, which results in the manifestation of our desires." E.F. Schumacher, in his book, A Guide for the Perplexed, suggests that there are four fields of knowledge. The first field of knowledge is knowledge of self, which is necessary in order to have any hope of understanding field two or three. Field four we are very familiar with because this is where all of our technical development has been and what we call modern science. The second field of knowledge is knowledge of others. As long as our knowledge of self is inadequate or colored by ego, self-interest will disallow anything more than a surface understanding of others. The third field of knowledge pertains to how others see us. Without knowledge of ourself, our inner being, it would be difficult for us to make progress with understanding of others. Without understanding of others, we can have little understanding of how they see us. The fourth field of knowledge is the knowledge of the physical world that we perceive with our senses. As long as scientists deny any field of knowledge outside of the fourth field of knowledge, they have no chance of understanding the life force that underlies their field of knowledge. This is precisely why technology has rapidly advanced to the point that any other field of knowledge is largely ignored or considered only superstition. It is interesting that the first field of knowledge corresponds with the universal law of being, which is the way we can become aware of our innate powers. We develop proper perspective that goes beyond relative thought and brings awareness of our pure potentiality. Only by knowing ourselves can we have any real concept of the whole that some call God and the absolute unity of all. We have only one primary obligation, and that is to evolve and unfold as a spiritual being. It will become our objective to expand our innate powers in order to make it possible for us to come into harmony with the laws of creation. I refer to as these laws of creation as the universal laws, and only by identifying and verifying them can we hope to transform our lives and claim our success. And that's my blog for this evening. Let's get to my primary guest, Pat Frascona. Had earned his BSc degree in geology from the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, and thereafter studied abroad at the prestigious Goethe Institute in Munich, West Germany. Upon returning to the United States, he joined the Washington, D.C. staff of California Congressman William M. Thomas. As a legislative assistant to the congressman, Pat was responsible for constituent services and preparation of congressional hearings, testimonies in issues areas related to the Department of Energy, Forest Service, and the Department of the Interior, including the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Land Management, and Reclamation. Pat later returned to his home state, where he earned his Juris Doctor degree from the Mississippi College School of Law. After law school, Pat worked as a full-time public defender for several years before entering private practice, where he has focused on consumer rights cases involving abuses by banks, credit card companies, consumer reporting agencies, and debt collectors. Pat's proclivity for fighting injustice eventually brought him to John Burroughs and Jim Penniston. In 2011, Pat organized the Mississippi UFO Conference, to which John and Jim were invited to give their presentation on Rendlesham Forest, on the Rendlesham Forest incident. And this is something we will cover tonight in more detail. Following the conference, Pat was asked to help with their struggle to obtain information and medical records related to their encounter in Rendlesham Forest. Since 2011, Pat has worked with John and Jim in addition to Nick Pope. Now, Nick Pope is a well-known investigator of UFO encounters in England. And, in fact, we'll be here July the 2nd. We'll talk about that a little bit, too. To publish the book Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, released in 2014, in which Pat contributed a chapter with Nick. Pat has been interviewed by numerous national radio shows, news outlets, and was a participant in the citizen hearing on disclosure at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. in 2013, and most recently a speaker at 2015 International UFO Congress. In April 2015, Pat was recognized for his contributions related to the Rendlesham Forest incident by Linda Moulton Howe at the 2015 Ozark Mountain UFO Conference. His work to fully uncover the truth of the Rendlesham Forest incident continues to the present day. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend.
I think it might be good if you could give some background on this whole incident. Most people have heard of the Roswell incident and so forth, but may not be as familiar with this one. Even though it was a U.S. base, it was in England.
Yes, England, 1980, December.
Could you give us some information, background on it, what happened?
Certainly. At the Royal Air Force bases, of twin bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge, which were actually being leased, if you will, by the United States Air Force. So there were U.S. Air Force personnel stationed at those bases at the time. And it was in December, late December of 1980, my client John Burroughs and, of course, Jim Penniston, among several others, were at the base that night when some lights appeared in what's called the Rendlesham Forest, which is adjacent to the bases, the twin bases. John Burroughs and Jim Penniston, along with Ed Kabancik, another person with them that night, responded to the lights in the forest. Ultimately, Jim Penniston and John Burroughs would be the only two to approach it up close. And Jim Penniston actually touched the object. It would turn out to be a triangular-shaped craft, say a little bit bigger than the size of a big SUV, approximately 8 feet tall. It had lights running through, different color lights running through the skin of the fabric, not like incandescent or fluorescent, more like a glowing type of light. There was static electricity in the air. There was even the sense of a slowing of time by the participants, Burroughs and Penniston, when they were in the vicinity of it. Ultimately, the craft would turn a brilliant white light, and it would ascend through the trees silently and without displacement of any air as it did so. And then it would disappear from about treetop level at what I believe it was Jim Penniston described at impossible speeds. So that was what they call the first night. There was a subsequent night in which Deputy Base Commander Colonel Charles Halt would be involved, and he would respond. And they had a little bit different encounter that night. There were multiple lights that would end up appearing in the sky, and there was also one large one in the forest, but they never encountered an actual craft. What they saw that night was constituted mainly by just lights. But the first night is the one that we focused on with John Burroughs and Jim Penniston, and of course in the book that Nick wrote with him, Encounter at Rendlesham Forest.
And the chapter that you contributed had to do with the case and your representation of Burroughs?
Yes. After I was after I met John and Jim, which I believe was in early 2011, they asked me if I would be interested in helping them obtain medical records, because prior to my meeting them, they had been trying to, particularly John Burroughs, had been trying to get medical records of his, because he had developed immediately after, or within, say, a week's time for sure, of the encounter in December of 1980, he developed a number of health issues, one of which was, of course, the most serious, related to his heart. Now, he had gone into the military, you have to understand, I believe it was 1979, and his entrance physical examinations did not show any problems with his heart or anything else, for that matter. Mm-hmm. After the incident, though, he developed a number of problems. He had trouble getting records from the government. His private physicians in Arizona, where he was living at the time, were wanting to see those records to help them with assessing what was going on with him. So I was asked to help them with that, and as I say in the book, it was an easy decision to make to help those gentlemen to do that. So we would then begin an effort using the Freedom of Information Act to try to jar loose whatever we could from all sorts of alphabet soup agencies, from DIA, CIA, NSA, OSI, DARPA, Department of State. And, of course, we got virtually nothing except from CIA. We were told they couldn't tell us whether they had something or not, what they called a GLOMAR response. They could neither confirm or deny that they had anything on it. And then I believe it was Department of State said that Air Force had something, but Air Force, I think, pointed the finger back and said, no, if anybody did, it would be State. And it became just a saga of the absurd at that point. It was obvious, becoming ever increasingly so, because the FOIA request we did went for about a year and a half, that nobody wanted to tell us anything about anything that had to do with the Rendlesham incident. So the book chapter, which I believe is chapter 17, details those efforts to try to get answers to the questions primarily related to John Burroughs' medical situation.
Well, it's absolutely a historic case, is it not? I mean, it's not ever happened that the government has acknowledged anything on this kind of thing.
Well, what would happen, thank you for bringing that up, what would happen eventually is we would enlist the help of then U.S. Senator John Kyle of Arizona. He had the case for about a year. He and his staff were unable to shake anything loose from the government, which was just unbelievable. At this point, John and I had already decided that we would pursue a federal lawsuit. That was something we announced in Washington at the National Press Club in April of 2013. And the reason was there was no other way to do it. Senator Kyle was not able to get anything. He was able to find out that John's medical records indeed existed, but they were classified. So we had a former service member whose medical records, which we needed to help him, to help save his life, literally, were classified, and nobody would give them to us. Later, we would get with Senator John McCain of Arizona. He and his staff ultimately were able to assist us. With the Veterans Administration, getting them to finally award John full medical disability for his injuries in 1980, meaning his contact with an unidentified aerial vehicle, the craft that he encountered in the forest. They awarded him full disability in January of this year. And the documents, a host of documents, about 20 perhaps in total, Some of the documents that they referenced in their own correspondence to John were documents related to the Rendlesham Forest incident. So in so doing, as we had released in a press release earlier this year, by de facto, they had acknowledged that an American serviceman had been injured physically by an unidentified flying object.
That's almost the disclosure they're talking about, isn't it?
Almost.
For years, the UFOlogist and others have been talking about full disclosure, but that's coming. That's doing so, but kind of obliquely, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. To our knowledge, there's no one else that this has ever, this has never happened before, where the VA has granted full medical disability to a soldier who was injured by something the government more or less says doesn't exist, but in this case they said it did.
Yeah, that's very interesting. We've got a caller here. Let's see if we got a question for you, Beth. Hello, caller.
Sure.
Hello.
Hello,
Hey.
Is this Patricia?
This is Pat Bullock Williams. Yes.
Okay.
Hey, James. Hey, Pat.
How are you doing?
Hey.
Oh, fine. Fine.
Did you have a comment on that or a question you'd like to?
No,
ask
I was just
well?
Calling.
Pat's
you.
Gonna,
yeah.
Pat is going to be Patricia Bullock Williams will be on our show July the 15th, I believe. But it's good that she can call in and talk on this one because she has done some work with Pat on it. Do you have some comment or question, Pat?
She's not only done some work with me, but she's also she did the transcript, the Halt tape transcript for the book for Encountering Rendlesham Forest.
So I'm also worked on the book, and Pat and I worked and met everybody at the UFO conference in Mississippi, and I also was part of the team that went to the coordinate site in Sedona that's mentioned in the book, the binary code, when it was translated. So besides a lot of research. So I just wanted to let you know I was here, so if anybody had anything else, I just wanted to make sure you knew
great.
I was here.
Glad to have you. Could you tell us what research was at Sedona?
What it was is when Jim Peniston touched the craft and was downloaded a series of zeros and ones, years later it was translated and realized it was binary code. And there are seven locations that it said across the world. One of them is in Sedona, one is in Greece, China, Belize, Peru, Egypt, and High Brazil. So a team of us went to Sedona and actually found the coordinate site that's out in the middle of the desert and actually went and experienced some things. We all had to sign non-disclosure agreements, so not to really discuss too much about what happened out there, but it was very interesting. And now people can go out there since the codes have been released.
Well, are you saying that there was a binary code downloaded to Pat Frascona's client?
Well, actually, to Jim Peniston, yes.
Right. To Jim Peniston, Renville, when he touched the craft, and he was writing down the symbols that he found on the side in his policeman's notebook, if you will. He was it a day or two later? He sat down at the base and he started writing out all the zeros and ones.
Well, actually, when he finally got to sleep, which of course he was on a different schedule, so his nights and days were probably mixed up, but he couldn't sleep, and all he kept seeing were zeros and ones in his head, and he thought he was going crazy. And he couldn't sleep, so he got up and went in the kitchen and just started writing these zeros and ones in his notebook. And he started feeling better. So he kept continuing it till he felt okay. And he put them in the back of his notebook because he knew if anybody saw them, that would be the end of his military career, and he forgot about them. And then years later, John Burroughs and Linda Moulton Howe and him were filming a special, and John asked Jim a question, and he was flipping through his notebook, and John caught those zeros and ones in the back, and Linda and John, and I think it was Prometheus Entertainment. I could be wrong on that. They found they saw the codes. It was Kim Sharon, I think, and they went and started to decipher them. Because
Prometheus Entertainment produces Ancient Aliens, is what she's
right.
talking about.
Yeah. Well, it might have been Kim Sharon, which I'm not. Yeah, she was with Ancient Aliens, I think, at the time. And so that is how the codes started coming out of
now,
these different locations.
Are we permitted to know anything about what that code told us?
Yes, it's in the book, the list of the codes, and it starts out saying exploration of humanity, and then gives a series of numbers, 8100, so like the year 8100. And then it goes through and gives the coordinates for High Brazil. Some people think that High Brazil is a location that has since sunk. It's not on land anymore. And then continuous for planetary advance. And then it goes in and it lists the other locations.
You know, that's very interesting. Whether you're in the Book of Revelation and you're looking at 666, which is the base number for it, is 9, or you're talking about the 144,000 be saved, the base number again is 9. Base number for 81 that you're getting there in the X-Nose is a 9. 9 is the number of completion of a cycle.
Yes. Mm.
And I'm wondering if this doesn't have something to do with that code, that what it's saying has to do with the completion of a cycle.
Well,
did you get
anything
James, like that?
Well, what's interesting is actually in one place it says exploration of humanity 666. 8100.
Yeah. And even that, if you're looking at the cycles, I did quite a bit of studying on this and wrote a book on this called The Mysteries Revealed. And 666, you can see the cycle because the 666 at the bottom is the lowest level of degradation and fear. The 144,000 is the highest level of love and light on the cycle. 144 is a base number of 9. The zeros just mean multiplicity without specificity. So it's a very interesting, as you go through the book, the numbers are a key part of the interpretation. That plus the dream symbols was a key part of the of me writing that book. But I didn't mean to get off the subject there. The
81. Well, no, that's fascinating,
It's fascinating that you say that shows up in the code, because it being the completion of a cycle. Each number,
yes.
1 through 9, has a conceptual meaning. And what galvanized me into action on the thing was I was studying the Hebrew meanings for each one of those numbers. In other words, you see 7 often in the Bible, which is a spiritual transformation. You see these particular numbers for different things. But what I found just astounding was that it was almost the same meaning for the Chinese and for the Indian numerologist as well. It was very, very close. How that should be so close. From completely and totally around the world
that's amazing.
The numbers,
yeah,
the base fine. Numbers. What did you gather anything from that code that that you would care to share with our listeners?
In Sedona? What was interesting is once
if
we
you
got
can,
there.
You know, what you can, what
yes.
you can share.
There were a few of us that were having overwhelming feelings there. And I actually started digging, and I found some rocks that have strange symbols on them. which I still have. And there was some, actually Jim kind of started seeing some things there. It was almost like a portal or part that almost like he was back at the site where
so he
was
having
in England.
Like a vision or picking up,
yes.
picking up something. Mm-hmm.
And we've had a few people go back out there. Some are psychics who have not been able to pick up a thing, so it has nothing to do with their ability in that way. But some other people have come out. Some of them actually have seen similar things to what some of the people that we saw there, that they had the feeling of a civilization there prior to this time.
Jim must be on the same wavelength, the same cycle, because of that experience in England.
Yes, yes, I do believe that, definitely. One other thing that's interesting that's in the codes, too, is it's actually a statement that says, eyes of your eyes, E-Y-E-S, your physical eyes. So it's eyes of your eyes, which a lot of people have tried to interpret.
You think that refers to the inner eye?
I could see that. Yeah, very easily could. You know,
the eye of the eyes.
Yes, you probably really enjoyed looking at these codes, James, since you have this knowledge. Actually, helped some on this.
Yeah, I'd just love to get out there in the desert with you guys.
Oh yeah, yeah. I can't wait to go to China to the other side.
Take plenty of water.
yeah, definitely. Now, what's interesting about the other sites is, there's one that's in Giza by the Great Pyramid. However, it's not right at the Great Pyramid. And the ones in Peru, they are not at the true Nazca. You know, everything's a little different. It's not exactly every spot. You know, there's some different areas. And then when you go to that site, you will see that there's some very interesting stuff there. The one in China is actually at Mount Tai, which is an ancient, very revered, ancient spiritual site that's in China. That's off the beaten path, definitely. So, you know, they're all very interesting where they're located.
Now I'm gonna refer to you guys with your full names, because both of you being Pat, if I just say Pat, I love to have both of you answering at the same time, but. Pat Bullock Williams. Now you're involved with MUFON in Mississippi.
Well, yes, I'm helping with the UFO Festival, the World UFO Festival, which
talk about that. That'll be in Memphis, Tennessee, July the 2nd. This is World UFO Day, and this is celebrated around the world. But this one is being, and that date, July the 2nd. Is the date of Roswell incident in New Mexico, which is probably the most famous of the UFO incidents in the United States, even though there have been many, 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 many more, and going back many, many years. That one is probably the most famous. July the 2nd was the date chosen for World UFO Day. It is being held at the Pine Hill Golf Club in Memphis, Tennessee. And this is because in 1977, a tri-cornered craft, same but much larger, as described by Pat Frescona earlier, came over Rodney Baber Park, which is near my home on James Road. And then a retired police officer friend of mine, who's now about 75, said it came over his house, looked like it was the size of a football field, tri-cornered, and moving so slow he couldn't figure out aerodynamically how it could stay in the air. And then it went over Pine Hill Golf Club. There it was. Police officers gave chase and were there. And you will hear on July the 2nd, the police officer who was in charge on the ground, Captain Todd, And he'll be talking about this. So this happened in 1977. It got major press coverage in the Press Cemeter in 1977. And then everything went very silent on it. But it got a lot of coverage there at that particular point in time. So that's why it's being held where it is. And we have some, the gentleman from England that you mentioned, Nick, what was his name?
Pope.
Nick Pope,
who is will be here and will probably, as I understand it, I talked to Bridget Sanders yesterday, who's in charge of the event, and she says that Nick will be speaking also, and she's finding room to get speakers in. Also, Pat, I mean, both of you Pats are going to be there, right?
We'll be
Pat,
there.
Yeah.
And Pat Frescona, are you're going to be talking about the case?
I don't think I'm going to be talking about the case this year formally. Possibly next year at the event, I hope. But this year, I'm just going to try to be there to enjoy it and hang out with Nick Pope.
I hope you can be on the panel and can talk about it, especially if either of your clients are there.
Yeah. Well, John Burroughs may be there with me, so.
And one of the other guests is Travis Walton, who was made famous by the movie Fire in the Sky. He says it didn't have a lot of reality to it, so he's had a documentary made where he gives the facts as he remembers them of the incident. So he'll be there. I'll be there also. I'll be talking about my book, The Father Confusers, which is about incidences in the Mahabharata, the Sumerian text, and the Bible that I think are actually witnessed accounts that they just didn't have a point of reference. They couldn't describe it any other way. And I give the example of Elisha describing the fiery chariot that comes down between him and picks up Elijah and flies away. He can't describe anything but a chariot because he's never seen anything but a chariot, and he can't describe the light because he's never seen anything but fire. So
exactly.
You have point of reference is what we're depending on from these 2,000 and 5,000-year-old and older witnesses. I think the smoking gun has been around a long time, and that landing on the White House lawn would be an aftermath, and not really as significant as some of the things that have already happened. Take into cases like Rendlesham Forest and others. Can we go just a moment to this case? This is very, very interesting. When you've got a case that is really, like we were talking about, is really an icebreaker, I might say, or, you know, just a historical type of thing. How do you account for that, Pat Frescona?
Well, I mean, we've debated this. I mean, on the one hand, you could say John Burroughs' medical condition had devolved to such a point. I'd gone to Tucson, for example, at the end of, I think it was 2013, for his heart surgery, which was performed that saved his life. I think the fact that, and it took quite a while just to get to that point, to get the VA to do that. Somewhere along the line, perhaps, the White Hats prevailed in this and said, look, we've got a man that we're going to leave back on the Cold War battlefield if we don't do something to help these people out that are trying to help him, including Senator McCain, myself, and so forth. That's one view of it. Another is somebody was simply succumbing to pressure. We were getting very noisy about this, and as many of the alternative media and what have you outlets that we could. And it's interesting, by the way, you mentioned Roswell being the most famous UFO incident in America. Rendlesham is in Great Britain, the same as Roswell is here. And John's case with the VA has actually gotten as much or more press over in Great Britain than it has in the United States. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, over there, the guy on the street knows what you're talking about just like they would here with Roswell.
Right.
But it's a shame there hasn't been even more here.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was in England myself from for 2 years, from about 83 to 85, and roughly in that time frame. And I remember even then hearing a talk about Rendlesham and other. They have a lot of incidences in the UK. There have been a lot of them, and so that I take it is what Nick Pope has been investigating.
Yes,
he has, and I think one more thing, if I could add to it, Renford, you know, when you go around the world, meaning outside of North America, I think there's just a general acceptance of this that's greater than here, both with the media and the general population give this a greater regard as far as credibility, these sorts of incidences than we do here.
France and in Mexico, both, they seems to, and I've seen a number of videos. A few years ago, the 60 Minutes type guy for Mexican television was at the Ozark Mountain UFO conference, and his videos were astounding. In fact, there was one, if you're looking at it, it was showing the camera was on a volcano. And in Mexico, and if you're with a naked eye, you're looking at it, and you just see a blip. You just barely know anything happened. And then when they slowed that down, it was a long cylinder object that goes into the mouth of that volcano. When they slow it down, pretty amazing stuff. Pretty amazing film all around. And this is occurring, it seems to be free and open in Mexico and in France. I'm wondering if it is not more difficult in the United States because we're guilty of collaboration. Are they worried about that?
Exactly.
Any thoughts on that?
I think so. I think part of the reason this case, the fact that this craft landed in the forest, which is actually a British forest, in between the two U.S. bases that were being rented, you know, from the RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, that it caused, in other words, the U.S. couldn't just file it away because it was also on British soil, even though American airmen went out to investigate it. So it kind of opened it up for not being just shoved away like so many of these others, which we tend to do here in the United States with our encounters. And like you said,
well, I think one of the most classic examples of what Pat's talking about, was it 2006, the craft over O'Hare Airport in Chicago?
That one
classic
was amazing. That was amazing.
You know, it's almost like, well, we're just going to pretend it didn't happen. It was weather phenomenon. That's what everybody needs to go believe.
And that one was seen by everybody, mechanics and pilots and passengers and everything else, and then just shot straight up through the clouds. That was an amazing one. I remember that one too. The Rendlesham Forest incident. It reminds me of this situation with your client walking out and touching this thing. Reminds me a little bit of the situation with Travis Walton. Now he says himself that he was kind of showing out a little bit when he walked out from the truck and the rest of the guys and were basically underneath this thing and got zapped. I'm just wondering what possessed him to go touch this thing.
Well, Jim was the one in charge out there, and he was he had a camera, and he was also writing down the symbols that he was finding and drawing the best he could at the time the shape of this, because, you know, he didn't know if it was Soviet or Chinese, you know, or us. He was actually hoping, the more he was looking at it, that it was going to say, you know, United Air Force or NASA or something on the side of it. Instead, he finds the symbols. So that's part of the reason. He really didn't think he was going to survive this. So he was writing down and trying to get as much information as possible. Of course, his camera, none of the film was developed, you know, or came out undeveloped, I should say. So now, why did
nothing,
he touch it?
The film would not develop.
The craft did it.
Question.
Yeah.
Right, right. There was either like some kind of radiation of the film, because you're not talking about digital cameras back then. So
yeah.
The film was either contaminated by that, or someone did it deliberately at the base lab.
Now, the damage to his heart, was that, do you think that was radiation as well?
To John Burroughs' heart?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No question.
Pats. I've got a call here. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we got a question here for you. Hello, caller. Do you have a question for my guest tonight?
Yes, I do. My name is Jim, and I'm from East Tennessee. Uh-huh. And I want to congratulate Mr. Prescott on his success. And I was wondering, have you heard of anybody who's not military who may have been exposed to radiation to successfully claim disability from Social Security?
Can you answer that, Pat?
From an unidentified flying object radiation?
I live up here in Unicoi County, Tennessee, near the city of Irwin, and up here there's a company called Nuclear Fuel Services. And according to some of the research I've read, you know, they tend to attract UFOs, and more than one occasion, not myself and also some others, we've noticed strange objects. Typical thing would be the cylindrical thing flying through the night or in the late evening. And after a couple of years, and we don't live near the facility, we live, you know, out in the mountainside there. I had a dog die. The vet said he died of leukemia. I'm 47, and I've developed maybe a little bit of a heart murmur. We just don't know if there's anything related to some of this radiation outburst, and is there anything related to UFOs through this, or just something else?
Well, insofar as the facility you mentioned, there is documentation for certain that things do seem to appear in greater frequency around, I'll call them energetic sites, like nuclear power plants and the like, and certain laboratories where things are being studied. As far as the injury, this, whether civilian or military, if the exposure, the proximity to the exposure is such, say within a few hundred meters, then I could see the injury happening to anyone, civilian or someone in uniform. Whether Social Security has ever recognized that, I don't know.
Yeah, we go hunting up there, and sometimes we'll come across the signs in the middle of the mountainsides there, and they'll say, you know, danger, do not cross, a lethal force authorized. We're like, well, you know, as far as we know, it could be some moonshiners up there or marijuana growers. They're pretty popular around here. And we just didn't know if maybe some of these UFOs, if they're trying to do a burst or something, either trying to gain energy or emitting something, so people who live in the valley around here may be exposed to some of this UFO radiation. And if so, you know, is there any way to document it with Social Security?
So Jim, I do is I'd cite the John Burroughs case in that regard as a case in support of that.
Okay.
But the original question was, do you know whether or not anybody has been able to claim disability, non-military personnel that have been able to claim disability due to UFO exposure? Was that your question, Jim?
Yes, sir. Or like you said, radiation from unknown origin.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know on the Social Security side. Don't know on the Social Security side. I'm not aware of that. Not aware of any. That doesn't mean there aren't. The only one that I'm pretty confident on is the military side. Let me add something here about this. When you talk about injury, first of all, the craft that we're talking about do not propel themselves in a force, you know, mass times acceleration kind of physics kind of way. Someone could be injured, say, by a jet engine if they were standing too close behind it when it was operating, okay? Something similar is going on with these craft when they're operating. If you're too close, there are injuries that come from certain types of radiation, let's call it. Of course, radiation includes, you know, the visible spectrum and everything else, but there are certain frequencies, we'll put it that way, that when they're operating are emitted, and that's what can damage a human observer if too close.
Now, this
but again,
be...
it's not the traditional propulsion way.
So this could be the anti-gravity they talk about a lot, could it not, Pat?
Well, yeah, but it's not so much anti-gravity as it is difficult to say here. There's certain things. When they're operating, they can move between points in space and time. Let's just put it that way. Now, if you want to call it anti-gravity, that to me denotes more of something hovering without any kind of visible means to do so, propeller blades or rockets or what have you. We're talking about when something's moving, right? It's changing its spatial and time orientation.
Okay, sir. Well, I appreciate your time.
I was just going to ask if you had a follow-up question there, Jim.
No, sir. Yeah, we're just going to probably have to, me and a couple of friends, we're just going to probably have to figure this out, cite that Mr. Burroughs case, go get the book, and go up here to Johnson City, go to the bookstore and get it and read it.
You mentioned you're hunting, right? So I wouldn't recommend shooting at anything up there.
No. we didn't think about shooting it because we didn't want to draw attention because Lord knows they probably have some black-suited wannabe ninjas out there working with that nuclear fuel and want to take somebody out.
Well, if you would contact the Tennessee State Director for MUFON is Eddie Middleton here in Memphis, Tennessee. And you can find him on the web, on their website. And it's possible that Patricia that's online with us tonight could tell you she's in the Mississippi MUFON, but she might can tell you where you could go to do a little research and get some information that you're looking for. Okay?
Okay. Well, I do appreciate your information. Thank you for your show.
Thank you for calling in.
Good night.
The event that's going to be here July 2nd, if anyone would like to go and check that out, it is World UFO Day Memphis.org. WorldUFODayMemphis.org. You can find out about what will be going on, about who the speakers are, and what kind of information you'll have. This is going to be very much a family event, even though there's some very serious speakers and people with serious experience with this, like Pat Frescona and Travis Walton and so forth. But it will also be a kind of a fun thing. You can bring the children. In fact, there'll be a golf tournament as well. It's at the Pine Hill Golf Club. Is there anything that you would like to add, Pat? We're getting pretty far into the show here.
You're talking about me?
Either you, Pat.
Also at the World UFO Day, we're having another speaker about Rendlesham who comes from a whole different viewpoint. It's Peter Robbins, who wrote Left at East Gate.
Yeah.
So that's another Rendlesham person who will be speaking as well.
I'm very pleased that you mentioned that that because I had left him out.
Yeah, and then also there's going to be the sci-fi, these magicians, close-up kings. I'm not familiar with them, but I hear they have a television show, and they're going to be walking around the audience actually doing live magic.
Yeah,
so it's a lot.
With children.
Yeah, live magic with children, yes. So there's a lot packed in that day, definitely. And vendors. And I know they're looking for vendors, so if anybody out there has anything, if they want to participate, please get online, and there's a link in there to become a vendor or inquire about that.
You can register. The entrance is free, but you need to register, and you can do that at worldufodaymemphis.org. And,
in fact, you have to have a ticket, even if it's free. You still have to have the ticket, yeah.
And any other last-minute thoughts with regard to the legal aspect of these things, Pat?
Well, I mean, the work is the work to continue trying to understand everything regarding Rendlesham continues. I mean, even though there's been much that's been found out in the last three decades or so since. Still not everything is known, but anybody that's got any information, because we came across someone here in Mississippi, as a matter of fact, I believe from Laurel, Mississippi, about 4 years ago, who had previously not come forth. It turned out to have been right there at Bentwaters, RAF Bentwaters, the night everything happened. And
he was a soldier as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he was there. And he gave a unique, a unique perspective of someone who was there and who described how he was instructed to go out in the forest, but he said he wasn't going. He was too scared. So it's interesting to hear that. So you never know who's out there that can answer.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who haven't come forward yet, stories. You know, and part of it's been fear or intimidation, or they've been threatened, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully more will start coming forward telling their story.
That's been a problem, but now you some of these, like Roswell, are getting so that the time, so much time has passed that those who have had experience there are no longer with us.
Yes,
true.
It
would be like trying to talk about Rendlesham 33 years from now. That's how long it's been for Roswell.
Yeah, good point.
Do we know if there were other incidences in England similar to that one around the same time, or was that a lone event?
I have heard and seen one account of another RAF installation called RAF Chicksand. I don't know how close, but I had heard there was an incident there. And also at Bentwaters, if I recall, there was something in the 50s that had occurred there. So something certainly has frequented those places.
Yeah, there's been a lot that's happened at Rendlesham or the Bentwaters Air Force Base over those last 20 years around that time period. You can go back.
Well, listen, it was a pleasure. We've got less than a minute, and it was a pleasure having this Pat duo with me tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, you're scheduled to be back with us July the 15th, so we'll be able to talk some more about this incident, and we'll also be able to talk a little bit more about worldufodaymemphis.org. Keep that in mind, folks. WorldUFODayMemphis.org. Get your information on that and come have some fun with us July the 2nd. But more importantly, come hear some very, very interesting speakers who've been there and done that, who've been involved. And thanks again for being with us, both of you, and everyone.
Enjoyed it.
For being with us on the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. And we'll see you next week. Have a good evening.
Good night.
night.
Good night.